Hello and happy Thursday, everyone. It's the Bill Buckmaster Show. Tim Steller, Metro columnist for the Arizona Daily Star, in for Bill once again this week. We have a good show in store for you, everybody, from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. In the first segment, this first half hour, we'll have on Steven Zylstra, president and CEO of the Arizona Tech Council, to talk about data centers, a booming industry in Arizona. And in the second segment, we'll have Melissa Del Bosque of the Border Chronicle to talk about the border, immigration, and the elections. The Buckmaster Live Line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. You can reach us here at 520-790-2040. And I'd like to welcome Steven Zylstra onto the show. Are you there?
I am here.
Great.
Ready to go.
Good, good. Let's talk. First of all, if you could introduce yourself a little bit for me. Tell me, you've been president of the Arizona Tech Council for a long time, as I recall. Can you tell me what that organization is about?
Yes. So we're a trade association for science and technology-based enterprises. We're a statewide organization. We have offices in both Phoenix and Tucson. All the brand name tech companies in Arizona that you would recognize are members. Probably 80% of our members have less than 100 employees. Hmm. We do public policy advocacy on behalf of the industry at both the state and federal level. We do close to 100 events a year. We have all kinds of publications, a magazine, a newsletter, a couple podcasts, reports. And we negotiate lower-cost products and services for our members. We have an association health plan with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona and a 401k program with Empower.
Oh, interesting. So, and generally speaking, you exist to promote tech business and tech businesses and that sort of industry in Arizona, right? The growth of these businesses?
Yeah, I would say promote, support, nurture, and defend.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, I don't know if you saw my column the other day that I got interested a while ago in the concept of data centers and AI and stirred it into a column the other day in the Arizona Daily Star. And it's about, my column was about just being careful about the impacts of data centers. But I think, first of all, I should ask you, it sounds like this is a booming industry, or at least a growing industry in Arizona, maybe a subsector here. What are these data centers, though, and what are they for?
Well, all of the data that each of us generates across the world every day is stored in a data center. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's us who are allowing data centers to grow because of the massive amount of information that we're generating on a daily basis. And the fact that it's immediately accessible to us has everything to do with data centers. Data centers are large buildings that are air-conditioned, that are full of what are called servers. And that's where the data is stored. And whenever you need to retrieve anything, you're actually interacting with a data center. And that's where all digital information is stored. And yes, we are second only to Virginia in number of data centers. And we we're number one in growth.
Yeah,
of data centers in the nation.
It's just to describe them a little bit. They're buildings that can be quite large, right? With just banks of servers or computers going down the corridors.
Yeah, they can be over a million square feet, you know, the kinds of organizations that have data centers in Arizona are just, by example, Google, Meta, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, PayPal, Amex, and a lot of private companies have their own data centers as well. State Farm is an example of that. So, anybody who needs to store data is either using a data center that stores information from a lot of people, or sometimes they have their own dedicated data centers.
Right, right. So there's actually a business where it would be like a third party that sets up a data center and then more or less leases out space to other companies. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So I've been reading about them. I think if the map I saw is correct, there are at least 85 of these data centers in the Phoenix area. Is that more or less the scale that we're talking about?
That sounds about right to me. Yeah.
The map I was referring to was put together by a firm, I think Iron Mountain, it's called, and they've showed 85 in the Phoenix area, 8 in the Tucson area, and 1 in the Nogales area, and those were all the ones on the map for Arizona. And as you mentioned, though, they are built by the tech giants who need storage for all this data that we're producing. But this is also this was needed even before the AI era, right? I mean, already we were storing all those millions of photos and stuff. And that's what you're referring to when you're talking about us pulling up, say, our emails or photos or whatever, right? That's what these...
Yeah, correct. And the AI era is only... let me say beginning, right? It's only been a couple of years since we've had generative AI, mm-hmm. and the talk of AI chips. So yes, everything I've described so far has been in place just for storing everyday data.
Right. And so correct me if I'm wrong, generative AI, which is the AI that we can query and get a significant response from, that needs maybe 10 or more times the amount of energy that a more simple AI system, such as the one checking your grammar and that sort of thing, requires. Am I stating that right?
My understanding is that if you have a server that uses AI chips, the kind that NVIDIA is now producing, for instance, that they can take 3 to 10 times more power than a traditional server.
Okay. And so that brings up one of the questions I had about impact. Well, first, before I go to the energy impact, I should ask about the jobs and the economic impact. I mentioned in the column, and you know, of course, that we have an incentive program that goes until 2033 that allows data centers to get rebates of sales tax on computer data equipment, if I'm right. Am I stating that correctly, the incentive program?
Yes. Let me talk first about why we have so many data centers.
Go for it.
And the incentive is one of those, which I'll explain. But the reason is that we have no natural disasters. Storing the world's data needs to be stored in places where it's very safe and not at risk. We see what's happening sort of around the world now as a result of global warming, and we just saw what happened in Florida. Arizona doesn't have any hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes. It might have a flash flood now and then. But so it's a very safe place to locate a data center. And then compared to a lot of places in the United States, we have modestly priced power. You know, we have the largest nuclear power plant in the United States with Palo Verde. So we have a very reliable grid. I think I recently saw it's the second most reliable grid in the United States. So for all of those reasons, it makes sense for data centers to locate here. But one of the incentives that was created many years ago by what was called the Data Center Coalition, and the Arizona Technology Council was part of that, essentially eliminates or waives, I should say, the sales tax on the acquisition of a server for a data center. And, you know, that is a significant incentive here in Arizona because, well, we have low property tax, low corporate income tax, flat personal income tax. We have a very high sales tax. So that does create a significant incentive in addition to all those other reasons why data centers want to locate here.
So why would we, the general public, want data centers to locate here?
So first of all, there are data centers everywhere. In every country, in most states, because we produce so much data.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's one of those necessary functions that needs to be not just here in Arizona, but just about everywhere in the world. First of all, it creates, when a data center is built, it creates construction jobs. And then that data center becomes a significant taxpayer as well, adding to the Arizona tax base. It's true that data centers are highly automated, so there's less jobs created, for instance, than, say, an advanced manufacturer or other types of technology enterprises. But, you know, it does add to the tax base.
Right. So in a given day, I know they're all different scales, but a data center may employ, what, a few people, 5-10 people or something like that?
It just depends on the nature of the data center. It can be from a half a dozen to 20 people.
Yeah, okay.
Depends on the size and the nature of the data center.
And when you talk about the tax base, obviously you're talking about things like property taxes that pay for schools and that sort of thing, right?
Yes, and corporate income tax.
Right, right. I'm talking with Steven Zylstra of the Arizona Tech Council here on the Bill Buckmaster Show. It's Tim Steller, Metro columnist with the Arizona Daily Star. One more thing before we go to the first break. We were talking about the incentives and the benefits. Is the energy use a problem or is it a benefit? Or they use a lot of energy, that's my understanding, and will use increasingly more as the AI, generative AI data centers come on. So is that a potential problem?
So data centers are the most significant user of power globally. Again, wherever you are, data centers, it used to be factories or foundries, and some factories still use much power, but data centers are the number one consumer of power in the Arizona, in the U.S., and in the world. So, but again, they're necessary in our life,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like today, it's like electricity and water. Right? They're essential to human life.
Data centers.
Today,
yeah.
Computers and devices that we use every day, data centers are essential. It does create a challenge in Arizona being able to produce sufficient energy, not just to power data centers, but the expanding advanced manufacturing industry and the annual growth of people and companies moving here is also creates more demand for power. So, you know, it's the responsibility of our utilities to do the proper planning and execution to create the sufficient power to fuel these industries and everyday life.
All right, we're going to go to the first break now. It's Tim Steller of the Arizona Daily Star on for Bill today, talking with Steven Zylstra of the Arizona Tech Council. This portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Mona's is located on the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Mona's is open Tuesday through Sunday for breakfast and lunch. Treat yourself to their mouth-watering pastries, including the famous Danish Kringle, monasdanishbakery.com or buckmastershow.com for a link to Mona's Danish Bakery.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops, craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
On average, the Regional Transportation Authority annually contributes over $100 million to regional transportation improvements to supplement limited federal and state funds. This critical funding source provides funding for nearly two-thirds of our region's needed transportation improvements through its 2006 voter-approved half-cent sales tax. To receive updates on a new 20-year plan in development, visit rtanext.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. And your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Good Thursday afternoon. It's Tim Steller in for Bill Buckmaster here on the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio on the campus of the wide-ranging Bustos Media. The Buckmaster Live Line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. I'm on the line today with Steven Zylstra, President and CEO, of the Arizona Tech Council. We're talking about the boom in data centers, which are these banks of servers that can be massive, up to 1 million square feet, he said, that store our data. And while we've already got maybe 90-some, almost 100 of them in Arizona, we are poised to accommodate more because the AI boom has barely even hit yet. And generative AI takes a lot more data than what we're already even producing. I'm sorry, it takes a lot more computing power than what we're already using. To pick up where we just were talking, about the energy demands and how the utilities will have to kind of make space for this growing demand of the data centers. My understanding is that also the data centers themselves are kind of taking on creating their own power plants and that sort of thing. Do you know about that?
Well, I think that's all prospective right now. Mm-hmm. There's discussion going on about that. Probably some statutory changes that would need to happen. Maybe some regulatory changes that would need to happen through the Arizona Corporation Commission, but certainly the prospect of both large manufacturers and large data centers providing their own power by either clean energy, primarily solar,
yeah,
or the prospect of modular nuclear. But modular nuclear is, you know, in its very infancy. There's some pilot projects. I think there's one in North Carolina. There might be, and then there's one in Wyoming that Bill Gates is behind. So, you know, that's down the line somewhere.
I was quoted in the column yesterday, a paper by a law professor, Barack Orbach at the U of A, and his son Eli Orbach. The title of it is "The U.S. is not prepared for the AI electricity demand shock." And the thing that jumped out at me that worried me is the potential effect on everyday ratepayers of the competition for the electricity. They write, "The most immediate effect of the demand surge will be increases in electricity costs, which will be felt mainly by those connected to power grids serving clusters of AI data centers." So the suggestion there is not just about Arizona, but about the country as a whole, that places where these are clustered will have a significant competition for electricity that could lead to increase in costs for everyday ratepayers. What are your thoughts on that? Is there anything being done to deal with this potential cost?
Well, I think that the cost discussion is speculative at best. At this moment, first of all of the power, all the utilities in Arizona have to submit IRPs, they're called, which is long-term planning, to show that over time they can meet electricity demand. I would say that, it's challenging, but it's doable. I think, they have to put plans in place that show they're going to be able to deliver power not only to Arizona citizens, but to the corporations and government and everyone else who demands power. I think it was in your article, you said that we need to produce 50% more power in the next decade.
Yeah.
The data I've seen somewhat correlates with that, which is 40% more in the next 7 years. So, one of the things that it also creates is an opportunity, right? We're in a sort of global, national, statewide transition to clean power.
Yeah.
And we're in a sort of transitory or transitioning phase right now where moving, completely away from coal, using natural gas, which is so much cleaner than coal, as sort of a transition fuel. So, this kind of transformation to clean energy won't happen overnight. But as the demand for power grows and as we're trying to transition, that means that a lot of the new power that will be generated will be clean energy.
Yeah, although I've noticed that the power companies are accommodating these new electricity demands by, in some cases, extending the life of the coal plants or even building new natural gas generators because they're so concerned about the future electricity demand. So while I see what you're saying, that yes, for sure they're going to be building solar plants. Orsted is building one in near Coolidge, and that will serve a data center in part. But also, I think we're probably going to see continuation, if not addition, of fossil fuel burning to help produce the needed power. You agree with that?
Well, there are, plans in place to shut down all the coal plants that provide power to Arizona over time. Those plans are in place. As you know, we've shut one major one down at Four Corners.
Yes.
And, you know, there are plans to shut the others down over time. You know, these are massive assets.
For sure.
Into which companies, the utilities, have poured a lot of capital over time. And so, you know, again, the transition away from coal and ultimately away from natural gas is just not going to happen overnight.
For sure.
You know, I think by 2030 or to 2035, we're going to see ourselves in a much better situation in that regard. And hopefully by 2050, we'll be at net zero carbon. So, you know, that's the plan. And, you know, that I don't know about TEP, but both SRP and APS have committed to be at zero carbon by 2050.
We're coming down into the last bit. Sorry to interrupt. Before we take off, I wanted to check with you on water. That's the other concern with these data centers. Many consume a lot of water. I understood from one piece of research that each inference or query of a chat GPT consumes the equivalent of 2.25 tablespoons of water. How is that going to work for us in Arizona?
Well, there's a bunch of things that are going on that will moderate that over time. First of all, there's new cooling technologies that are being developed that are...
I'm going to have you wrap up. I'm sorry. But rest assured, they are trying to minimize water consumption. Thank you, Stephen Zylstra of the Arizona Tech Council. I really appreciate your being on.
More than happy. Thank you for the time.
Sure. Take care. This is a Bill Buckmaster Show.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Are you ready to immerse yourself in a diverse culture while wandering through bustling markets, sampling exotic cuisines, or forging connections with people from all walks of life? Well, Bon Voyage Travel is here to plan your perfect journey. Whether you're setting off on a solo expedition, embarking on a group adventure, or simply dreaming of far-off destinations, we can help create your custom experience. The road ahead is filled with endless possibilities. Visit bvtravel.com to find your specialized Bon Voyage Travel advisor today.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The News and Sun's media reach 75% of the region through newspapers, websites, social media, video, newsletters, and more. They also produce more than a dozen print and digital magazines annually for an audience of 70,000. Find them at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, covering your hometown.
The extraordinary beauty and craftsmanship of Mexican artisans is yours at Clay and Cloth in Barrio Viejo, featuring gorgeous clay pottery sourced from southern Mexico, including Oaxaca, Puebla, Merida, and Hidalgo. Also discover amazing textiles you won't find anywhere else in Tucson. Clay and Cloth also has an incredible selection of new Dia de los Muertos merchandise. See the selection on Instagram at Mad Max the Dog Shop and visit Clay and Cloth. Open Tuesday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 310 South Convent, just south of Cushing.
It's the Bill Buckmaster Show. Tim Steller sitting in for Bill. I'm the Metro columnist at the Arizona Daily Star. We're in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio. Speaking of which, Green Things has since 1970 been the go-to place for your gardening needs. Green Things is on a lovely 13-acre site that is also home to Zocalo Village and all of those fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things on River Road, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park, and on the web at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com. I have in the studio here with me Melissa Del Bosque, who I've known from a distance for a long time, but then she moved to Tucson a while ago and we got to know each other in person. She founded the Border Chronicle a few years ago and writes about issues related to the U.S.-Mexico border, immigration, and that sort of thing, along with her colleague Todd Miller. Melissa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
it's,
sure.
It's good to be here.
Tell me a little more about your background. I want to kind of set it up for the listeners. Like, how did you get into this gig of writing about the border, writing about Mexico and U.S. relations, that sort of thing?
Sure thing. Yeah, so I'm a longtime border journalist. I started in Texas. I actually grew up in San Diego, so that's how I got very interested in the border, because I lived in a border community, moved to Texas, and reported on the Texas-Mexico border for about 20 years and then moved here to Tucson after the pandemic. Well, 2021, I guess we were still in the middle of it.
Yeah.
It seemed like it went on forever. And joined Todd Miller, who's a longtime border journalist from Tucson. He's been here in southern Arizona for a long time. And we started a publication called The Border Chronicle on a platform called Substack. So it's an email newsletter that goes out. And since we have both been reporting on the border, Todd and I, since the late 90s, what we really feel is lacking or missing from border coverage is context and analysis and history. And since we've been doing this so long, you know, a lot of our reporting is linking back to things that happened in the past, context, you know, analyzing what's happening now, because, you know, everything that's happening now didn't just happen out of the blue. It's been building up over years, and also has a lot to do with Mexico as well. Obviously, we're very close to Mexico, and you know, the borderlands are two countries, and really its own country, the borderlands. So very unique region.
Yeah. So tell me, before we move on to talk about today's politics, there was a book you wrote, I don't remember how many years ago, titled Bloodlines. Tell us a little about what that was.
Yeah. So that book came out in 2017. And, you know, as I said, I've been reporting on the border for a long time. And when you know, what they refer to it as the drug war in Mexico broke out around 2007, 2008, everything changed. Especially on the Texas border with Mexico and Tamaulipas, Chihuahua, those Mexican border states got especially violent. You know, the military was sent in, and this violent conflict started. So it really changed everything. And so my book centers around a drug cartel called the Zetas. Mm-hmm. Which came out of the Gulf Cartel. They were armed enforcers for the head of the Gulf Cartel at that time, had military training, ironically trained by the U.S. to fight narco trafficking, but then turned around and went to work for the drug traffickers because they paid them better, right? So they used these military tactics, and it really changed the game in terms of the conflict in Mexico. And Bloodlines is about a specific case dealing with money laundering through quarter horse racing, which is very popular in the borderlands, you know, on both sides. And through the Trevino family, the Trevinos were the head of the Zetas cartel that time. At that time, Miguel Trevino, this is the mid-aughts. And actually, there's a documentary out on Apple TV right now called The Cowboy Cartel about that case, and I'm in it being interviewed. And so Bloodlines was really my way of figuring out what was happening exactly with this conflict, who were the Zetas, how were things changing, and what kind of impact was that going to have on us and on both countries.
Yeah. So coming up to the present day, obviously we have presidential election going on, an election of all kinds of positions right now, very long ballot. But in the presidential campaign, we've seen a lot of talk about the border about immigration. Well, let me start with Tuesday's event. On Tuesday, I believe it was Tuesday, J.D. Vance was in town. I don't know. Did you keep track of what he had to say related to these themes?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically been a furthering of, you know, immigrants bad, immigrants very, very bad, mm-hmm. terrible for, mm-hmm. for our country. And I think he made some remarks about how, you know, children who are immigrating to this country who didn't speak English, were going to drag everybody else down in public schools. Mm. Him not understanding that in Arizona, actually, you know, when kids come in to learn English, they're in a separate school or a separate classroom mm-hmm. from the kids who already speak English. So that doesn't even actually apply. But yeah, a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric.
So the main thrust of the Trump campaign, or one of the main thrusts, I should say, has been the idea of people coming across the border illegally, or at least between ports of entry, and acting as criminals, committing crimes here in the United States and endangering regular American citizens. What is your take on that? Is that a legit commentary on what's happened in the Biden administration? Is that alarmist? Or what's the situation there?
Well, something that I write about a lot at the Border Chronicle is this notion of an invasion. So we hear a lot of talk in MAGA circles, you know, and from Trump and Vance about invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been very active in pushing legislation, and we see that in this proposition that's up right now, you know, the Secure the Border Act, where a state can designate an invasion and then, you know, deploy National Guard and arrest people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that Texas is already doing right now with a program called Operation Lone Star. And this has been a major push by former cabinet members of Trump's, like Ken Cuccinelli, Russ Vought, for the last 4 years they've mm-hmm. been pushing this. And our former AG, Brnovich, had mm-hmm. come out with an opinion that we could declare an invasion. And really the idea behind this is it's like the states' rights movement, where they want states to have their own control over immigration enforcement rather than the federal government, which, you know, also goes back to Senate Bill 1070 here in Arizona, right? And we've seen various states try to pass these bills where the state would have authority over immigration, which I think would be a bad idea, because in every state's got a different policy towards immigration, which seems like not a good idea.
So there's a new incident that J.D. Vance and others have spoken up about. Happened just the other day, a Tucson resident driving from Tucson to Nogales to Puerto Penasco, apparently didn't stop at a criminal checkpoint somewhere near Altar, Sonora on Highway 2 there, and was shot and killed. Vance said at the rally the other day, the man who was shot and killed, by the way, is a former Marine. Here's the other thing Vance said. I think we've got hundreds of thousands of very fine Marines, soldiers, sailors, and airmen who are pretty pissed off at the Mexican cartels. I think we'll send them in to do battle with the Mexican drug cartels too. I mean, this isn't the first time someone said this. Donald Trump has said this kind of thing. Other politicians of the right have said this. What's the point of saying this kind of thing politically, and what are the prospects of this actually playing out in reality?
I mean, this unfortunately goes back many, many, many years. I remember reporting in 2009, 2010, with there being checkpoints, criminal checkpoints set up in Tamaulipas, which is a Mexican border state. You know,
on the Gulf, yeah.
Yeah, with these criminal checkpoints, and when people run them, the criminals go after the people who run the checkpoints, and they shoot them up, and they kill them. I mean, this has been going on for, unfortunately, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
This isn't anything new. And by saying that, it's a very sort of naive, I guess, response to a very like deep-seated issue, right, that's happening in Mexico, which has to deal with, you know, the federal government having control over the country, and also with corruption, right? Because you have federal forces who are involved in this corruption as well.
For sure.
It's a really deep-seated problem that has a lot to do with corruption.
Yeah.
And you can't just solve it by saying, oh, we're going to designate them a terrorist organization and go in and bomb them or something, because then you're violating sovereign territory of our biggest trading partner and our neighbor who we are not at war with. And so it really shows that you have actually no understanding of the situation.
Well, so what would happen? Let's say Donald Trump wins election. Let's say he actually does send in special forces of some sort for some sort of attacks on labs or individuals to take them to U.S. custody or something. I mean, can you imagine how that would play out in Mexican-U.S. relations?
Yeah, and I mean, with the Patriot Act, you know, that was, you know, signed after 9/11, the U.S. has all of the tools, the money that it needs to go in and fight these guys already. I mean, the DEA, different operatives from the U.S. are deep within these organizations already. They don't need to take a drone in and shoot at them. I mean, that is like just taking a hammer to a fine mechanism, uh-huh. You know? I mean, the U.S. is already really deep in this. I don't, just by saying, oh, you're a terrorist organization or doing that. I mean, sure, rhetorically, politically, it sends a message, but actually doing something, it doesn't.
I have a sense that people who stand up for immigrant rights or believe that we should accept people in as asylum seekers are feeling very much on the back foot right now, because not only has Donald Trump and his campaign, I think, successfully pressed the issue of illegal immigration, quote unquote, but also the Democrats in response have more or less adopted a slightly less severe version of the same Republican policies. Is that how you're feeling, or people, immigrant rights activists who you talk to, or is that how they're feeling?
I mean, this is an issue now all over the world. I also work for an outlet based in Europe who covers migration. And it's been very interesting comparing their issues over there to what we're facing here. And this is really a global issue. We have, you know, boatloads of people who are going across English Channel trying to get into England. You've got thousands of people dying in the Mediterranean who are trying to reach Europe from Africa. We have thousands of people who are dying coming here from Latin America and from other parts of the world now as well through the Darien Gap. So this is a global issue, and it's an issue that a lot of governments are trying to deal with right now. And in the U.S., they've basically dealt with it by not dealing with it, really. The Democrats haven't really acknowledged it much. Mm-hmm. And then you have, like, Trump and his folks coming out with this very sort of reactive, like, these are invaders, these people are coming to hurt us. And then the Democrats have largely remained silent, which was a huge mistake, because all they can do now is just respond to this framework of we're being invaded, you know? And there have been, you know, influxes of people coming from around the world and arriving in small towns in the U.S. who aren't used to seeing this sort of thing. And I think the federal government has done a bad job of preparing communities for this or assisting them. And I think border communities have been dealing with this for a long time. I mean, when people arrive, this is, you know, where they arrive. They arrive at the border, and folks have just kind of dealt with it on their own through humanitarian groups and so forth. So the rest of the country now is getting a sense of what it's like to be a border community.
Got it. We need to go into the next break. This is the Bill Buckmaster Show. Tim Steller of the Arizona Daily Star on here with Melissa Del Bosque of the Border Chronicle, talking about the border in political rhetoric these days.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. In 2006, Pima County voters approved the Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year Regional Transportation Plan and half-cent sales tax. They are both effective through June 30th, 2026. For the region to receive continued funding for another 20 years, the RTA is developing a new plan and tax extension for voter consideration. Public input will be key. To receive updates on a new 20-year plan in development, visit rtanext.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com. This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
We're back on the Bill Buckmaster Show. It's Tim Steller of the Arizona Daily Star, Metro columnist there in the studio here with Melissa Del Bosque of the Border Chronicle. This segment brought to you by Silver City. Our friends over in Silver City and Grant County are ready to welcome you back with open arms. Just 3 hours east of Tucson, there is so much to do in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, including hiking in the Gila National Wilderness, where there is plenty of social distancing, and visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. I'm sorry, it's a Gila, what is that, the Gila Cliff Dwellings? Yeah, Gila Cliff Dwellings National Monument there on the Gila River. Beautiful place. For a complete listing of the many things to do and great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. As I mentioned, I'm on the air here with Melissa Del Bosque. She founded the Border Chronicle a few years ago with Todd Miller. It's just been fascinating to watch the transformation of journalism about the border. I know when I covered it from 1997 to 2003, it felt like there was maybe six of us across the whole border, literally. I mean, it was definitely less than a dozen.
Yeah.
Now it's really changed. I don't know. Can you tell me about the change in journalistic coverage of the border?
I mean, when I decided I wanted to be a border journalist, it was I was really influenced by, they used to have border bureaus, actually, and this came out of NAFTA in the mid-90s.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
There was a lot of interest in Mexico because of NAFTA. So I remember Texas had all the major newspapers, you know, the Dallas Morning News, they all had border bureaus, and I thought, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
I want to be in one of those border bureaus, and I want to be going back and forth between the two countries because it's really the best of both worlds. You're a domestic reporter, but you're also an international reporter, which is what is so cool about reporting on the border, because it's local, it's It's national, it's international.
Yeah.
But of course, by the time I started in the late 90s, those border bureaus were already closing down, you know?
Yeah.
So I've always been a sort of self-professed border journalist, because it's not really a title like most publications hire for. They hire for an immigration reporter.
But
border reporting is more than immigration. It's environment, it's business, it's anything that's happening in the borderlands.
Right.
You know, so it's all those things, right?
Culture. I've seen some great profiles of the people who go back and forth or hang around by the border.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, there's also a massive industry, which is the border security industry, which is just huge now too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not really a lot of coverage of that, you know, of all the sensors, the drones, the surveillance towers, everything that us taxpayers pay for, right? That's in border communities. And how does that impact communities? And what are we paying for? Does it even work?
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of scrutiny.
I've heard of it referred to as the border industrial complex.
Yes.
Is that something you or Todd Miller came up with?
I don't think we came up with it, but we definitely use that terminology. Yeah, just to take off from, you know, the military industrial, we'd have the border industrial complex.
And is the suggestion there, just let me connect some dots and correct me if I'm wrong, that the perception of an out of control border can lead to the reality of spending on technology, people, businesses that deal with border security. Is that how that works?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's nothing better for business than saying that the border is open, that we have an open border, or that it's chaotic, because then, you know, you're spending more money on sensors, more money on, you know, surveillance. Actually, the Biden administration has the highest budget for DHS more than any other administration. Like, it doesn't matter who's in the White House, basically.
Just keeps going up.
We just keep spending more and more and more, billions and billions more on the supposedly open border. And this notion of an open border is just hilarious, right? Because the border is completely under surveillance. You know, unfortunately, we have thousands of people dying trying to cross the border. We now have people dying who are falling off the wall and so forth. So it's really anything but an open border.
Yeah. Oh, it is. Okay. So you think that's a false narrative completely?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think people are responding to people arriving and asking for asylum, you know, because we still have a U.S. asylum law where people can apply, they can ask for asylum anywhere on the border. Anywhere they touch U.S. land, they can. That's our law. But I think a lot of people are under the impression, or the rhetoric, the political rhetoric, is that you can only cross through a port of entry to request asylum, but that's actually not the case. And it's very restricted at ports of entry. You can only cross that way if you have a CBP-1 appointment, which is this app that the Biden administration has rolled out, where people can apply from afar for an interview.
At the port.
And then they can cross the bridge.
Yeah.
But it's not enough appointments to meet all the people who are arriving.
So the demand is outstripping the supply, and as a result, there's some spillover, I guess, between the ports of entry. Is that one way of putting it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people who can't get an appointment, or they don't have a phone, then they end up going between the ports of entry to present themselves to an agent and ask for asylum.
Got it. Well, that's all the time we have now. Thank you very much, Melissa Del Bosque of the Border Chronicle. You can check her, the Substack that she founded at Substack, Border Chronicle. And this is the Bill Buckmaster Show. Thank you for listening.